from the parents' perspective. "It's so strange," Marcia was talking with her friend Susan on the phone. "Melanie seems to be in need of a whole new wardrobe. She's been trying on all her clothes and they just sort of hang on her." "I know. She's been exercising more." "Yes, she does look a bit thinner." "No, I haven't noticed her eating too differently, though she seems to have a real yen for her favorite ice cream now that I think of it." "Well, you don't lose weight by overeating." "No, I really didn't think of it as binging." "Oh, wow, that's a whole different story. Maybe I better get her to Dr. Gray for a checkup. Oh, dear, I can't believe I didn't even think of that." From a parent's perspective, what should we know about eating disorders, and how can we keep our children off that slippery slope? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest is one of the country's foremost authorities on eating disorders. Dr. Michael Strober is director of both the Eating Disorders Program and the Adolescent Mood Disorders Program at UCLA's Neuropsychiatric Institute. He's also lead author of a new book, Just a Little Too Thin, How to Pull Your Child Back from the Brink of an Eating Disorder. Dr. Strober is the father of two young adult daughters. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Dr. Strober.
Thank you.
What's the most important thing parents should know about eating disorders?
Probably the most important take-home message from any introduction to the subject is, number one, the potential seriousness of these conditions, and number two, their potential to be long-lasting.
What kinds of things tend to last out of these, even when a child is finally treated and theoretically cured?
Well, let's take the discussion to anorexia nervosa first, and then we'll talk about bulimia, and then extreme dieting, and what might represent milder forms of each of these conditions. Okay. Anorexia nervosa is the most serious of the eating disorders, and one of the most serious of the psychiatric disorders when you consider that it is the most lethal of all psychiatric disorders. Approximately 5 to 6% of people with anorexia nervosa die from the illness, and death occurs relatively early in the lifespan. So if you have anorexia nervosa, your odds of death greatly exceed expectation. And when you consider the fact that most people with anorexia nervosa die between the ages of about 20 and 35, considering the death rate amongst women in the general population, anorexia nervosa thus becomes the most lethal of all psychiatric disorders. Once you develop the illness, it tends to run a very, very protracted course, which means that several years go by before people are well recovered from the illness, at the very, very least. And bulimia, likewise, tends to run a waxing and waning and on again, off again course for several years for most people that are affected.
Is this because people don't notice it right away, or because it takes so long to treat that, you know, it just has to sort of run a kind of a course?
It probably is a function of many things. Delays in getting into treatment is one, and resistance to treatment. Many people initially are very, very reluctant to treat this condition because one of the underlying aspects of the illness is fear of weight gain, fear of normal weight, which probably relates to a predisposition within people that develop eating disorders to fear and anxiety generally. Once it develops, the fear, the anxiety, the apprehension, the terror, the discomfort with even normal weight and shape is really very, very difficult to comprehend. It is it's intense, and as intense as it is, it's long-lasting. And the nature of the illness is such that these people are very compulsive. They're very rigid in their basic nature, very compulsive, so they hold on to behavior for a long time. And when you combine that with their tendency to be fearful individuals, that is what creates partly the tendency for these conditions to just linger on for very, very extended periods of time.
Dr. Strober, before we go any farther, would you clarify for us what is anorexia nervosa and what is the difference between that and bulimia?
Anorexia nervosa is a illness characterized by extreme and irrational weight and shape concerns associated with dieting behavior and then gradually extreme weight loss. So when the illness is fully manifest, you see extreme weight loss, fear of normal weight, extreme apprehension of weight gain, and an apparent indifference to the amount of weight that is lost, an indifference to the emaciated or malnourished state, and oddly enough, a tendency to see the body as larger than it actually is. In bulimia nervosa, the characteristic features are repetitive binge eating or gorging associated with some form of attempt to minimize the impact of the amount of calories that are ingested, usually self-induced vomiting, but you can see things like extreme exercise, cycles of restriction so that binge eating alternates with periods of extended restriction of the diet, vomiting, laxative abuse, abusive diet pills or diuretics.
In your book, Just a Little Too Thin, How to Pull Your Child Back from the Brink of an Eating Disorder, Dr. Strober, you discuss three stages of an eating disorder. Would you explain what these are?
Yes, and it's important to note that we wrote this book for parents of children who are dieting. We wanted to write a book that was giving parents a perspective on how to attend to dieting behavior, not necessarily eating disorders per se, in the hope that they can recognize the early warning indicators and help teenagers who are dieting so that this dieting does not progress to more dangerous levels. And the slippery slope describes the passage from dieting behavior to more extreme dieting behavior to the really being at the brink. So we'd characterize the three stages as innocent dieting, the exhilarated dieter, and then the obsessed preoccupied dieter. Innocent dieting is just what you might imagine it to be, a reasonable, healthy approach to dieting behavior. And in this case, we're talking about teenagers who have a balance between their activity and their efforts at losing weight. Eating behavior is characterized by a regular pattern of eating. These are kids who are dieting, but they're eating throughout the day. They're finishing their meals. They restrict their calorie intake, but they don't do it to an extreme degree. And they maintain their reasonable emotional and social functioning in all regards. Exhilaration is something that's very, very different than innocent dieting, and that is where the teenager really becomes entranced with the notion of being able to master their eating-related urges. They really have a satisfaction in being able to curb the diet. And this is different from innocent dieting, where there is an understanding that the child is attempting to lose weight, but not through starvation. In the case of exhilaration, there is a sense of satisfaction in being able to master the urge to eat, being able to control or vanquish the urge to eat, which is why exhilaration frequently precedes obsession and preoccupation, because the more you try to master the urge to eat and control eating behavior, the greater the likelihood of it evolving into obsession and preoccupation. And the obsessed and preoccupied dieter is one who is really burdened by constant preoccupation and worry about what they should eat, what they shouldn't eat, when they should eat it, when they should not eat it. And we see in this stage changes in eating behavior, such as cutting food into small pieces, moving it around the plate, the inability to engage in conversation at the dinner hour, avoidance of eating in social situations, and then ultimately changes in mood, especially the development of more irritability, interference with schoolwork and sleep, because the degree of self-imposed restrictive eating behavior is such that the person begins to show signs of semi-starvation.
Pretty terrifying to hear your descriptions of what goes on. I've also heard and read before about physical manifestations of this illness in terms of your kids losing their teeth and other kinds of physical things that happen to them as a result of malnutrition.
Very much so. With repeated vomiting, there's an erosion of enamel which can lead to very serious dental complications over time. There are a variety of changes in the body physiologically that are associated with semi-starvation. Girls lose their menses, or there's disruption in the cycle. There are a variety of neurochemical and hormonal changes associated with semi-starvation that affect attention, concentration, and mood. Bone disease is a potentially serious and quite prevalent problem as you begin to lose weight, and if that weight loss is sustained. We see bone disease very commonly in girls with anorexia nervosa as young as 12, 13, 14 years of age, and that can be, you know, that can have long-standing devastating consequences.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on eating disorders.
Washington, D.C. with Kids, an excellent book by authors Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Michael Strober, author of Just a Little Too Thin, How to Pull Your Child Back from the Brink of an Eating Disorder.
Now, parents can spot what kinds of kids are most likely to become anorexic?
There are indicators, and interestingly enough, in the last 10 years, we've learned a great deal about personality traits, personality characteristics that are associated with risk for developing extreme dieting behavior. Extreme perfectionism, the tendency towards extreme worry and anxiety, discomfort with change. You know, life, of course, is about change. And people who eventually develop anorexia nervosa are people who tend to be chronic anxious worriers who are also very rigid, very compulsive in their daily routines, and who have marked difficulty with change. So to the degree that you see these characteristics, there is a greater risk for developing extreme dissatisfaction with weight and weight gain at the time of puberty, and thus the risk increases for dieting behavior. Not that everyone with these characteristics will develop eating disorders. In fact, only a minority will. However, when you look at the people who develop eating disorders, these traits are unusually common.
It's interesting because we're all picturing young women. What happens to men, boys, with these kinds of personality traits?
Well, interestingly enough, when you do see boys with eating disorders, they have the same personality traits associated with the problems in females. We've known about eating disorders in males for quite some time, in fact, hundreds of years. It comes as a surprise to many people that this, in fact, is true. And whereas it is the case that males are much less affected than are females, their risk for developing eating disorders and these extreme dieting preoccupations is less than what we see in females. They do occur, and the characteristics are precisely what we see in females, and the risk factors are pretty much identical to what we see in females. Again, I would stress the fact that what our goal and objective was in writing this book was to help parents understand something about the background of girls and boys who develop more extreme weight and shape preoccupation, what some of the warning indicators are, and how to identify the slippery slope such that when teenagers begin to diet, parents can be informed and they can be knowledgeable, and they have a set of guidelines as to how they can assist their child who is dieting and intervene when intervention is necessary.
How can parents provide an atmosphere at home that supports healthful eating without saying, "Did you take your vitamins? How many calories did you consume today?"
It's a challenge. However, knowledge based upon what we know about the psychology and family environment and emotional life of adolescents prone to dieting behavior allows for parents to be better informed. And once parents are better informed, they are better able to provide an environment that's educational for their child, an environment that is supportive, and an environment that is sensitive. And it gives them a sense of what to say and when to say it. And we give a number of examples in the book of how parents can approach their child who is dieting. What are the do's? And what are the do-nots? because parents understandably tend to react with frustration, concern, and surprise when they hear that their teenage daughter, who looks relatively healthy and fit and reasonable in weight, wants to go on a diet. The common response is, that's absurd, you're ridiculous, don't be so silly. And this helps very little. It doesn't deter their child from dieting. So parents can be informed and knowledgeable in many ways. They can be sensitive to the impact of social factors and media influences and peer influences that affect attitudes about weight and shape and dieting behavior. And we provide them with some background in these areas and how to discuss these matters with their child. We educate parents as to the role that family factors play in the development of these problems and how a parent's own background can shape their sensitivity to attitudes about their own weight and shape and how they can be more cognizant of this and what they can and cannot and should not say to their child, and then how to spot changes in behavior that indicate the potential for difficulties and specifically what to do when they see these things. So we provide what we think is a very comprehensive education for parents on the one hand and set of guidelines on what to do when they see these things evolving.
Would you be a little more specific about the roles of siblings and peers when a young person has this kind of problem?
Yes, we know that a very significant issue here is the tendency to be teased by peers. Teasing plays an important role in attitudes about weight and shape. Body image dissatisfaction is intensified when children are teased about their behavior generally, or their appearance, or their weight and shape. So there's a very strong connection between teasing and body image dissatisfaction. And likewise, teenagers are exposed to peers who wish to lose weight, who comment frequently about the desire to lose weight, who are on a diet. This is not unusual at all in the teenage population. So the exposure is going to be there. It's impossible to avoid it. And for somebody who is insecure or self-doubting or vulnerable, these are powerful triggers. And parents have to be aware of them to be cognizant of how frequent these triggers are in the environment, and to provide an environment for their child where the two of them, or the three of them, and siblings as well, can talk openly about the pressures that teenagers face.
The media bombard us with images of extreme body types. And that, I would imagine, is pretty tough on kids that are already sensitive in this way.
It's ever-present. It's impossible to avoid. Parents can do all they want to try to shield their kids from it. It will fail. It will fail. You cannot prevent your child from being exposed to these kinds of media pressures. What parents can do is be more literate. They can be more familiar with what their child is reading and watching. And they can talk to their child about these pressures. They can talk to their child about what the media does to merchandise dieting and thinness and how pernicious an influence that is. They can talk to their child about how the media uses technology to distort pictures that their child sees. And they can bring to their child other media figures or celebrities who have very positive, admirable qualities and emphasize the importance of those qualities. It's not an easy thing to do, but it can be done.
Do you think boys have an easier time of it in terms of body image than girls do?
Yes, they do have an easier time because the changes in physiology are far greater for females than males. The media pressures, the social message, and the social pressures for females are very, very different. Females are pummeled with the notion that you need to be thinner. And that's not the case for boys. Boys are encouraged to be more muscular, but girls are encouraged to be as slender as they possibly can and to do whatever they can to alter themselves cosmetically. And that pressure is not directed at males to the same degree.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on eating disorders.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $10 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Michael Strober, author of Just a Little Too Thin, How to Pull Your Child Back from the Brink of an Eating Disorder.
It's interesting when you look at pictures of movie stars from past eras. They would not pass today very well because they're a lot heavier.
That's true. The pressure today within the Hollywood community, particularly amongst females, is to be as thin as you possibly can. And interestingly enough, some of the non-teenage celebrities, I hesitate to refer to these women as older because they're not old at all. They are young, they are still vital, and yet they talk openly about the importance of trying to keep their weight low. So this is a pressure.